Of course, that means when I stop talking, we're done. But I just wanted to recap what we had been talking about. Yesterday, we had been thinking about the Schwarzschild geometry. I had motivated the discussion by talking about stellar collapse in the evolution of stars. If you end up with an object that's too massive, you get into a situation where there are no known forces that are going to prevent or overcome the force of gravity, and the collapse just continues. And so what we had to do is we have to really come to grips with these interesting places in the Schwarzschild geometry, namely r equals 0 and r equals 2m. One of the things we did, though, was we found some interesting coordinate transformations, which suggest that r equals 2m is not really a problematic, but just an interesting place. And so the first set of coordinates that we used were these infalling Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. And there's a metric drawn here. And the interesting thing about this metric is it's well behaved at r equals 2m. This goes to 0, but even at r equals 2m, that's a perfectly well behaved space-time metric. On the other hand, r equals 0. There's still a problem in that there's something going to infinity here. I also drew this pretty picture, which is supposed to give us some intuition for what's happening. So on this board, vertical lines are lines of constant r. In looking at this, what we found was that surfaces of constant v, i.e. if I sit on a surface of constant v and I move around, I'm moving in a null direction. And so I drew the surfaces of constant v at 45 degrees to sort of use our intuition or to stimulate our thinking, because in Minkowski space, when we draw the space-time diagrams, null rays go at 45 degrees. So if I'm moving along this direction, I'm moving in a null direction. But then the question, well, then we looked at what the other direction, what the outward null direction was for any particular point. Out here, it looks like just a normal light cone with the lines going at 45 degrees. But then as we approached r equals 2m, that other leg of the light cone was tipping over. It becomes vertical right at r equals 2m. And then it actually tips over past the vertical and is pointing towards smaller values of r inside r equals 2m. Another very clever coordinate transformation, which I call Kruskal coordinates, although the book calls it Kruskal, and then I'll have to ask Joseph, how did you say that? Sekeresh coordinates. This coordinate system puts the metric in this form here, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. The components now still have r's in them, even though there's no, a comment is, this is just shorthand for d theta squared sine plus sine squared d phi squared. I used it over here. This is just shorthand for the spherical or the angular part of the metric. But there are r's here in the various components, but we've gotten rid of the r as one of the coordinates in the metric or in the that I'm thinking about varying in the line element. And so r is implicitly, though, given as a function of capital U and capital V by this equation here. And so when I draw my picture in the UV plane, fixing a value of r gives us a hyperbolic or a hyperbola in the plane there. In this particular coordinate system, again, the coordinates or the metric is well behaved when I go to r equals 2m, but there's a problem when I go to r equals 0. The picture now looks like this, or the picture that I drew last day. The surface r equals 2m was a very special, or it's the degenerate hyperbola. It's just given by the lines u equals plus or minus v. And so that's given by these orange lines running at 45 degrees. R equals 0 is u squared minus v squared equals minus 1. And so there's some hyperbola up here. or some line up here that represents r equals 0. And so that's the same singularity that we had as a vertical line in the other picture. And so I talked about surfaces of constant r. Surfaces of constant t are just straight lines. They define lines in the UV plane. As I vary t, what I'm doing is I'm changing the slope of the line. And so there was some nice equations here that said that, well, as I'm varying the slope of the line, I'm running from t equals minus infinity down here to t equals 0 is just a horizontal line. And then I get to t equals plus infinity at 45 degrees. But then the curious thing is I can go inside r equals 2m. I'm still getting straight lines, but now they run t equals plus infinity. They get smaller and smaller. Then t equals 0 is the vertical line. And then I go over to 45 degrees at t equals minus infinity again. I've also drawn the picture there as filling up the entire UV plane. And so I mentioned this in words, so I just wanted to recap the story, that there is what's known as the maximal extension, or the book calls it the Kruskal extension of the Schwarzschild space-time. And here what we're thinking about is just the abstract idea of solutions of Einstein's equations. And in particular, we're treating this as a solution in the absence of any matter. So that geometry solves Einstein's equations everywhere, but I'm not including a collapsing star. I'm just treating this as the solution, and I'm going to explore the space as much as I can. So we treat this as a solution with no matter. So the first comment was that we had actually, when we talked about Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates, we had said that there was a choice we could make. This set of coordinates, which corresponded to my V plus, I called infalling coordinates. It happens that what that corresponds to, or the lines of constant V or V plus, are again lines that run at 45 degrees in this picture. So this dotted blue line is a line of V equals constant. And V equals infinity is off in that direction at infinity. But V equals minus infinity actually corresponds to the orange line here at T equals minus infinity. And so those coordinates over there cover, or this picture covers the quadrants 1 and 2 over here. Those, well, as V runs from minus infinity to infinity, I'm covering the top half across the diagonal. So, but then I had a choice. I could choose these V minus coordinates, which were outgoing, hopefully I got that right. So there was another choice I could make where I switched the sign. And those corresponded to outgoing Eddington-Finkelstein coordinates. But in that case, what I would find is I'm looking at lines running at 45 degrees here. And I could explore geodesics that are running radially outward. I would find that they emerged from this surface in a finite proper time. And I could extend things past this surface of t equals minus infinity. And I'd find a new region of the space-time here, which I've labeled 4. And that region's identical, the geometry here is identical to the geometry in this region that we called the inside before. The only difference is, as you can see from the way it fits into the diagram, is that people traveling to the future, or light cones, are now directed upward in the diagram, and so everybody's moving towards larger and larger values of r, which is the opposite of here, where everyone was forced to move to smaller and smaller values of r. This is another branch of that same hyperbola. That line there also corresponds to r equals 0.
So that was a lot of words. I should write something on the board. So as a first step, we find we can extend this region or this quadrant that I've labeled with the 1. So that's this R greater than 2m region between the two orange lines. So we can extend it past that orange line. Where the geometry And so well, one way you can do that, or one way you can probe that, is by using the outgoing coordinates. And then the difference was, though, that in this region, in some sense, time runs upwards, or future directed light cones are running upwards towards larger values of R. Is everybody happy with that set of words?
Sure. When you redo for with,
where geo, meaning short for geometry, I believe.
Where the geometry is identical to that found in 2. What did I say? Well, found for R less than 2m. And then once I have these regions, I can play similar games. I can follow geodesics backwards here or to the future here, and I find that I end up in a new region where the geometry is again identical to the region 1, or the geometry where R was greater than 2m. And so what we discover is that there's another asymptotic region on the other side of the UV plane, with R heading out to infinity over there. What's that? 2. So similarly, we extend past the boundaries of 2 and 4 into 3, where the geometry is a curious footnote is that if I look at the way I've labeled the diagram, t equals minus infinity sits up here, t equals plus infinity sits here. I'm still, to be consistent, the light cones are pointing upward everywhere in the picture, And so geodesics here run from t equals plus infinity up towards t equals minus infinity. But I emphasize that that's a footnote because it's just a labeling thing. It's not that we're running backwards in time or anything strange like that. It's just that in the way I happen to have labeled the diagram, the t coordinate runs backwards on that side of the picture. So I won't write that down so that people don't get confused when they're reading their notes. But what that means then is that my full geometry, if we take into account so this maximal extension contains two asymptotic regions, or two asymptotically flat regions. And so if I look at the surface V equals zero, or I run along this line, what I find is that I'm in an asymptotically flat region. As I move in, R is getting smaller, the spheres are getting smaller, and then I hit R equals 2m, but that's the smallest that the spheres get, because if I go past that, R is getting larger again, or the geometry is that the spheres are getting larger, and they expand to infinite size on the other side. And so that's often known it comes up in discussions as the Einstein-Rosen bridge. You may also have seen that in an exercise where we talked about isotropic coordinates. So there was a coordinate transformation that put the Schwarzschild metric into a form where you had dx squared, dy squared, plus dz squared. And what you see there is that, in fact, those coordinates don't take you into these regions of the space, but rather they cover this region here and that region there in a very natural way. Somehow the inside disappears in that set of coordinates, but you get both of these asymptotic regions. So are we happy with that set of words, or that's okay? We also have this R equals less than 2m region with a singularity in the future. So there's in that region too. But we've also ended up with a singularity in the path down here in this region 4. So this is an interesting as an exercise in mathematics. Again, in a context more familiar to physics, I'm going to have a star that's generating this curvature, this geometry in the space-time, and the star will only, well, this is only the geometry outside of the star, and so the star cuts off the bottom half of this diagram, or there'd also be a slice that cuts off the bottom corner of the Eddington Finkelstein picture. So, but it's an interesting, well, it's still an interesting result or thing to think about. And so for the collapsing star, the matter in the star is changing the geometry. And so we only see a portion that I talked about there. The next thing I wanted to comment on was just make some more comments about this coordinate system and why it's a nice coordinate system. So why did, for example, Martin Kruskal get so excited when he saw, or not Martin, Martin was the mathematician. Why did John Wheeler get so excited when he saw this coordinate system and he could start drawing pictures like this? So when I write a question on the board, that's usually when I turn to the audience and I ask, any suggestions?
That's one of the key things. We have this intuition, or if one works with special relativity great deal and space-time diagrams there, we're used to this idea that light rays everywhere are running at 45 degrees. But what we can see in the metric here is there's some number, it's a positive number, and then there's minus dv squared plus du squared. So that looks just like Minkowski space. And so, as Joseph said, is it Kennedy?
Yeah.
Joe. Okay, as Joseph said, the light cones everywhere in that picture are just running at 45 degrees. So no matter where I am, the light cone sits at 45 degrees. So, some positive number minus dv squared plus du squared, which looks like a key space for the light cone. The other thing that I can see, which is obvious as well, is that V is the time direction everywhere, or the time time-like coordinate, whereas U is the space-like coordinate everywhere. Thank you. another nice thing about this coordinate system.
Chris, we have the exact same spherical symmetry we're used to.
Didn't like my list, but okay. Spherical symmetry is manifest.
Well, I mean, it's just that we don't give it up in order to get the other aspects.
In fact, I'll come back to that in a moment. When I'm drawing this picture, I'm drawing a UV plane, and so I'm drawing slices of the space, and we're talking about motion, if you like, in the radial direction there. But in general, at every point in this space, I can also head out in other directions that are the angular directions. And so at every point here, there's actually a sphere's worth of extra geometry that we haven't explored yet. Any other suggestions?
Question. When we want to transform coordinates into something that looks like flat space-time, we see that it is locally possible. And
right.
Now we're saying that, you know, this sort of transformation can be extended everywhere.
Well, I really haven't accomplished, I think, quite as much as you said, in that what I've done is I've taken the G and the R coordinates, assigned that part of the metric, and I get something now that's very close to Minkowski space. But there's still this function sitting in front of U and D, and there's also this angular part. So I haven't quite, I mean, I haven't generated a freely falling frame or anything like that, but I have put the metric in a form where we get to import intuition about space-time diagrams when we're looking at that picture. And so it's a lot easier to think about the physics when I have that picture now. That was the main idea. Good job,
I have a question. People call this the maximal extension all the time. So why is it maximal? Like, I don't think I've done anymore. I wouldn't have expected this much either.
Well, what I've done implicitly, although we didn't do it, is we just sat in the same time and we shot out geodesics in every possible direction. And we found that, you know, we could go from here to here in a finite amount of time. We could also go into a region here and similarly. But there's no other places to go. A problem. Well, as soon as someone tells me that nothing happened at R equals 2m, the next step was to say that some of the geodesics, though, end up running, you know, there's a piece of UV plane out here that I'm not using. And that's because the geodesics, well, we ran into a problem here. They got there in a finite amount of time, but we don't know what to do next. Did that answer the question?
So like if you have some kind of like space time, the way you find the rest of it, you can just call geodesics and whatever you get is all of it.
Essentially, yeah. That's not a very probably a very practical way, but that's
also is that not how this was done, like I guess.
How the coordinate system was come up with? No. But, I mean, it was a mathematical exercise that somebody gave. But with hindsight, well, there's all this. Let me get back to that in 1 minute. Was there another question over here?
I think maybe here. So, what do you mean? I was always had the impression that the Schwarzschild geometry was something like, it was like the most general spherically symmetric space-time of some kind. Like, I mean, it's obviously not the most general spherically symmetric space-time because things like effort.
Yeah, the solution of Einstein equation without a vacuum.
Oh, yes, vacuum everywhere except the singularity. Right. So what do you mean by like sort of, Like, how can you have an extension of such, like, you can't, like, it's the most general already.
Right, but, so, it is the most general, but for example, in the, you know, before the 1950s, people looked at the Schwarzschild metric, and they thought the physical part of the space was what we now call this coordinate path for this region one. And they just didn't want to think about physics here, they didn't know about that, they may not have known about that.
Okay.
And so, you know, they had a metric, they had a line element, and they were doing physics with it, but they were not, you know, just, they weren't exploring regions of geometry that with hindsight, we now say, well, it's obvious, there's all of that. So, I mean, we said this before, but the other thing I wanted to put on my list is that there's nothing bad happening, nothing bad happening at r equals 2m. Both the UU and the VV components are finite. I think r equals 2m in there, and I just get a number like 16m squared. Yeah, 16m squared. And so that just emphasizes that any of the problems we saw before, that was a labeling problem or a coordinate problem, or the singularity we saw in the Schrodinger coordinate was just a coordinate singularity. The previous weighted problem is r equals 2m was the coordinate singularity. But then we had this other singularity or this other problematic place, r equals 0.
And as marvelous as this coordinate transformation was, we still have a problem at r equals 0 because the components of the metric are blowing, or these two components of the metric are blowing up there. So it's not a proof that somebody's done a coordinate transformation and it's still there, but it's reflecting the fact that this is a real singularity. By which I mean that, well, the geometry just goes bad. The curvatures become infinite. I run into a real problem. The spherical symmetry, so the simplest things we can say about that sphere is that its size is still controlled by R. As Chris said, that we haven't changed that part of the geometry, and so the sphere is big out here. It goes to zero size here, and it has a finite size everywhere in the middle. But as I described for the Einstein-Rosen bridge, that means if I run along across, it gets smaller for a while, but then it starts getting bigger as I keep running across a line of V equals constant.
I was just wondering, how can we be sure that some singularity which we see in a particular coordinate system is not a coordinate singularity, and how can we be sure that it is a physical, it has some physical reality?
So the the real answer is going to come next week, I hope. when we learn about the curvatures, so that the things that characterize the stuff that's really there that I can't get rid of. And then what I would do is,
so what we're going to find is that I have a curvature tensor. That's a covariant object, or it's something that changes under coordinate transformations. But I can use that to build scalars or invariant objects. So I can construct something like that. And what I find is that that's an object that varies as some power. I think it's going like m squared over r to the 6th as I approach r equals 0. And so the curvatures are, or this curvature invariant is diverging. And so that's telling me there's no way that I can do a coordinate transformation to get rid of that problem. Yeah,
we've made a coordinate transformation, but yet we are still talking about r, which is implicitly an implicit gen on u. What if you make r explicit in terms of u and discuss about the singularity in terms of the new coordinate u and v? What would be the change? Because I seem confused when we've made a coordinate transformation. Instead of discussing based on the coordinate system u v, we are still talking about r.
Right. So I had implicitly a formula that gave, you know, u squared minus v squared equals something. That's actually a transcendental equation, so there's no closed form solution for it. If you give me u and v, or if I give you r, I can tell you where that surface is here. But I can't write a closed form, you know, r equals this. Even if I could, one way to think of it is I invent new functions. And so essentially what I would do is I'd have some new functions up here
with u's and v's. So I'm not, the problem is that it wouldn't lend any new insight to me anyway as to what the geometry is doing. The nice thing about r's in particular is that, you know, we still have this idea that the spheres have a certain radius. And so, for example, when I'm going to r equals 0, that sphere is collapsing to 0 size. I don't know. Did I answer the question, or?
Why not in terms of u explicitly and v?
Because it would be a big mess. OK.
Any other questions? Okay, so there's this aside, the curvatures, the spheres. So I could think about, when I'm sitting here, the radial motion, radial trajectories, or physical trajectories, are always going to be inside those light cones there. But one might worry that that's not really representative of general motion in the geometry, and that what if I'm moving in the angular direction? If I project that trajectory, could I sort of move off in this direction somehow? And that would sort of change our intuition about how things move in this space-time. And so there's a little exercise just to show that that's not true. Was that clear what the question is, or why I'm asking the question? Well, let's do the exercise and then. So let's think about in particular, what I want to do is I want to allow for theta dot, or d theta by d tau, or d theta by d lambda to be not equal to 0. And similarly, I might think about phi dot not being equal to 0. I still have my constraints, though, that the interesting physical trajectories are either going to have a minus one here for time-like trajectories or a zero. Here, I'm using the word trajectory very consciously in that I could be thinking about an accelerating observer. He will still, though, satisfy this constraint, even though he, point by point, even though he doesn't follow a geodesic trajectory. And so let's just write out what this constraint is. Well, I have my metric here. So this becomes and then that equals, depending on the case, minus one or zero. And the important point is that these contributions are positive, or, well, if they go to zero, they go to zero. And so if I rearrange the equation slightly, what I would end up with, I guess I'll use a new. Is that I'm going to take this, stick it on the other, well, I'm going to multiply through, and then I'm going to isolate that. It's going to be equal to u dot squared plus stuff, and the stuff is going to be involve this constant, which, because I put it on the other side of the equation, is now plus one, or zero. And then the angular terms and then we had to multiply or divide out by that. So there's an r over 32 m cubed e to the plus r over 2m. And the point is that I've got v dot squared equals u dot squared plus junk, and the junk is always greater than or equal to zero. And we can, well, we might note in passing that it's only equal to zero for a null geodesic when the angular components are vanishing. In any event, the conclusion that I wanted to emphasize is that v dot squared is always greater than or equal to u dot squared in general for any physical trajectory that we might think about. So someone moving in a time-like direction or null signals. And so what that means is that if I just massage that slightly, I divide by the u dot squared, I get dv by du squared is greater than or equal to 1, which means that if I project a physical trajectory into that picture, into the UV plane, I end up with a line that has a slope that's bigger than or equal to 1. And again, it's only 1 when I'm thinking about a null radial trajectory. So we've only drawn a slice of the full space time, but the point is that the intuition we have about what's connected and what's not connected, or how you can get from one place to the other, or when you cannot do that, is properly guided just by looking at the light cone structure in that single slice over there. Is that clear?
So I can't sneak outside of the light cone by possibly traveling off in a radial direction.
Another point that I've alluded to, and perhaps I should have just said it before, is that we have this singularity at r equals 0. But if I look at the picture now, that slice is a space-like slice. By which I mean that, well, if I'm sitting on any surface of constant r in this particular region, and I'm moving around in that surface, I'm only moving in space-like directions. And so that's what I mean by saying that it's a space-like surface. So it's like a slice of constant time in Minkowski space. But what that means then is that the star, if we had a collapsing star, it doesn't collapse to a point of infinite density, which then sits there in the space-time. Rather, it collapses to a point where the density goes to infinity, or the sphere collapses to zero size over here. But then it actually drags, in some sense, the entire space-time geometry down to a singularity along this wake, or along this space-like surface that extends away from it. So we might have had, so this is a cartoon, we might have had the impression that we're getting something like this. The star collapses, makes this singular thing that then propagates forward in time, but that's, so this is no. What we really have is that it collapses down, and then there's this singularity that extends out, or that there's this singular time slice that extends out from that point. But that's a, in some sense, a real problem. Not just the star gets to this point, but at this point we don't know how to carry physics forward, because we're running into these divergences. But similarly, if we have an observer or some extra particles falling in here along a geodesic, they get to this point in a finite proper time. And then we don't know what happens next. We can't use our technology of Einstein's equations to get past this point, and we're going to need a better set of equations. And so this is something I alluded to a long time ago, that was that Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts its own demise. It says that I will get to places in my space-time where everything just breaks down, and I don't know how to carry forward with physics. So we're unable to evolve any physical system forward in time past the singular surface using the current technology, or the technology of Einstein's theory of general relativity. So GR predicts. I'll go on with that a bit in that one might have hoped, or something that people ask is, well, is this singularity just an artifact of the symmetry that I've imposed on the problem? I mean, what I said is that this is the space-time geometry outside of a spherical star. So I've imposed some very rigid symmetry that there's no angular dependence on anything in that geometry. And I've ended up with this, well, from the first time we see it, it's some kind of curious behavior. But is that, you know, in the real world, stars aren't perfectly spherically symmetric. You know, the density isn't perfectly uniform everywhere. There's angular momentum in the system. You know, could it be that when a real star collapses that I avoid this problem here? And in fact, the answer is that no, this behavior is in fact a generic behavior. So for gravitational collapse. Even without spherical symmetry. However, the and I might add as an aside that that's not an obvious statement. That's a result of a lot of work. And the technology that people have used, or the most powerful theory that goes into this, is something known as singularity theorems by people like Hawking and Penrose. And others. However, the other interesting thing, though, is that there's this null surface, or this event horizon. When I'm in this region, I can't communicate. We commented on that before. The null cone is tipped over, and so if I'm sitting here, or some physical event happens here, no matter what signals or effects it produces, those only propagate towards the singularity at r equals zero. They can't be communicated to the observers who sit outside of r equals 2m. And so the nice thing is that even though there's a singularity or there's this problematic place here, the observers outside here are shielded from the physics of that singularity by what we'll call the event horizon in a moment. And so the reason that GR is still a useful theory is that even though these singularities are pervasive or occur quite generically, they're always shielded by some kind of a horizon. And so as long as we're talking about the physics outside of the black holes or outside of the gravitational collapse, then we can still use GR as a predictive theory. So. So we can still use GR as a predictive theory to describe. Physics outside, or in the asymptotic region, or outside the black hole. And in the same way that the formation of the singularity is generic, one expects, although it's not proven, that this idea that singularities are always shielded by a horizon is also expected to be a generic property. And that goes by the name, well, maybe this cosmic censorship. Cosmic censorship. And I'll emphasize that it's not proven, it's a conjecture. Says that this behavior should also be generic. Okay, so those are just some side comments, and there's a question from Aaron.
Two questions. First of all, I've heard a claim that certain kinds of non-spherically symmetric collapse can't cause naked singularities. Is that like not widely accepted?
I think what you're actually thinking of is a spherical collapse.
Oh.
Are you thinking of self-similar collapse?
I'm not sure. I just remember reading some sort of...
So again, this is a conjecture,
yeah.
And it says that this should be generic. So what people Shostakovich did is he set up... if you set up non-generic initial conditions, that in fact are...
Okay.
Well, the ones I know about are spherically symmetric.
Okay.
You can, it's actually done numerically, you can evolve it forward, and what you do is, well, if you run into this singularity, then it seems that there's no event horizon, apparent horizon, and world horizon. So there,
okay. In so part, there's a measure zero set of conditions for the happiness.
Sorry?
So there's a measure zero set of conditions for
the that's what it's
Or there's at least a measure zero set. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and the other question was, is there any sort of reason to believe that GR works at all inside the event horizon? Like anywhere, not just
does not work, or does
it
work?
Does work. Is there a reason to believe that GR works anywhere inside the, is there any reason to believe that there is any point inside the event horizon at which GR works?
What I would say is yes, and that's a good lunchtime discussion to have, The gist of it would be that, in fact, when one studies GR more carefully, it's very hard to decide where the event horizon is.
Okay.
And so an observer who's following through this event horizon can't really tell that they've just crossed an event horizon. And so the physics that they experience here is pretty much the same as the physics they experience there. And so it's only really here that we know the equations break down. So we believe that, well, until, you know, maybe the curvatures don't have to go all the way to infinity when they're very large. Okay, so those were some comments.
The cosmic censorship conjecture, the question is that does it state that general relativity is the theory, is a predictive theory outside the horizon, or does it say that it's the physical theory outside the horizon?
So I think it's the former, although I'll have to get my lawyer to interpret your question.
I mean, when we talk about the cosmic censorship conjecture, that's a conjecture made about GR. So if you had some other theory of gravity, you'd have to come up with your own conjecture and your own evidence for that conjecture. So I think implicitly here I'm saying that the theory I'm interested in is GR.
Is it?
If you like, I mean, what the conjecture, I mean, that's something that we infer from if this result is true, then I can make statements like that. But the conjecture, or the, you know, the discussion of the conjecture itself is really, you know, refers to, you know, when you really form a singularity, what are the properties of the space-time around it, there are different versions of the conjecture. You know, what I imply is that there's always an event horizon, which I think is known as the strong censorship conjecture. There's a weak conjecture which says that if there is a singularity, you'll never observe it. I mean, the only way to detect a singularity is by running into it. That's actually a slightly different statement than saying there's horizons. But that, the discussion of the conjecture is sort of a detailed mathematical, you know, discussion of Einstein's equations and how space time is going to be. So, so in the last hour of the talk, no reaction from Dennis. what I wanted to do is turn things back to perhaps a more physical setting to get some better intuition for what's going on in these pictures or what the physics is of these pictures. And so what we're going to do is we're going to consider two observers.
And we'll, well, I'll just let that picture sit. And what we're going to think about is a stellar collapse. And so I'm only going to take a piece of that diagram. So here's the singularity. Here's the surface of the star. For simplicity, later on in the discussion, I will say that the star is just made of dust. There's no pressure. And these objects are all, or the dust, these collection of particles are just collapsing onto themselves. I'm going to, that's not essential for this part of the discussion, but I'll use that later to make the surface of the star easier to describe. So there's star in here, Schwarzschild geometry out there. One of my observers is going to, oh, and there's this, well, I'll just draw it like that, because this is the UV plane. No, that's V. So this is my R equals 2m surface in the Schwarzschild geometry. The details of what the geometry is along this segment, just like all of that geometry, is a little bit different, but I'm connecting that null ray up to R equals 2m in the Schwarzschild geometry. And my observer A is just going to ride in along the surface of the star. So he's going to start in the region of the space-time outside of R equals 2m. But then he'll just follow the star in, crossing that, and ultimately crashing into the singularity over here. Our other observer, as always, is an observer who sits out in the Schwarzschild geometry at some fixed radius and angles. But he'll be sitting some distance away at some fixed radius r. And so he's following. Yeah. his trajectory is following one of these hyperbolas. And so it comes in the UV, the VU diagram, and then it continues up and asymptotes to the R equals 2m surface. And he's sitting at an R equals, say, capital R. So observer B sits at fixed radius R. And we'll just emphasize that he's at some large R. He's not at infinity, but he's at some large value of R. So what I imagine as well is that A is sending out light pulses at regular intervals according to his proper time. So his proper time, I'll just use tau sub a as shorthand. And so these are lines that are heading out at 45 degrees again. But what we might notice is that on the B trajectory, the pulses are arriving at larger and larger separations. And in fact, after we've crossed R equals 2m, in fact, the pulses are still going out, but they are captured. They're crashing into the singularity here at R equals 0. So if R sub a is greater than 2m, so once I've crossed R equals, or once the observer's crossed R equals 2m, his pulses always end up at R equals 0. But that means then that R equals 2m is the boundary between these two classes. R equals m, or the pulse and in, this is why, well, maybe it's not why. This boundary generically then can happen in more general contexts, and that boundary then between the region where signals can get out to infinity and where they can't, or where they can escape, or and where they're trapped, is called the event horizon. Having crossed R equals 2m, this observer gets to see all sorts of exciting physics. The star is reaching infinite densities. The curvatures are becoming arbitrarily large. And in a finite proper time, the observer actually reaches R equals 0, or the singularity. And what, well, what one of the problems yesterday was saying is that that proper time is actually, or the maximum proper time is actually set by the mass scale or the size of the black hole M. And so that proper time is always less than or equal to pi times M. So this person has a very dramatic journey and sees all sorts of interesting physics. On the other hand, we might ask what B is seeing. So this part of the journey is actually lost. So A's journey is lost to B because we said that he can't send any signals. He can't report anything about his adventures inside the black hole or inside the event horizon. And so what one thing I commented on is that the spacing of the signals becomes larger and larger because his trajectory is actually in the UV plane, asymptoting to this line, r equals 2m, that runs at 45 degrees. And so the reports that he sees are coming more slowly and more slowly. And so he, the observer B never quite sees the observer A actually reach or cross the event horizon at r equals 2m. Another comment is that if I think about the spacing becoming longer and longer, that's a reflection of the redshift that these signals are experiencing as far as B is concerned. And so even if A is emitting, he has a certain laser, his laser is always emitting at a fixed frequency, the signal that B observed is being redshifted ever more as I approach r equals 2m. And so we'd like to put some equations to that in a moment, but there is actually another effect which we can allude to. What we saw is the other day in talking about photon orbits is that some of those orbits, if I'm sitting in this region near r equals 2m, some of the orbits are actually, if they're sent out with some angular component, they're actually being trapped as well, even before I reach the surface r equals 2m. And so there's a smaller, and as I approach r equals 2m, there's a smaller and smaller cone of light that can actually escape from this person's experiment. And another way of saying is that the light that escapes actually gets spread over a bigger and bigger solid angle as it rises up from the star. And so the effect of that is that not only is the signal being redshifted, but the luminosity or the photons per unit time that are actually getting to B is being reduced because those photons get spread out over a bigger and bigger piece of the sky out here. So the luminosity
ask this, but can you please repeat what you said? Because that seems contradictory to me. You're saying that as it the light or non-radio light rays are captured, the angle is increasing.
Well, yeah, I said both those are. But
not quite that way.
Well, yeah. So just like you said, so the luminosity of the signal at the
almost like decreases.
And so what was the picture? Well, the picture was that what we had before was that here's a is my end horizon that I was doing. We thought about an observer who is sitting at a stationary or a fixed radius. This problem's a little bit different in that this guy's in a free fall. But what you might remember is that there was only, you know, a certain cone of null rays that could escape out. And that cone was shrinking dramatically as I moved down to smaller values of R. But if A is holding a light bulb here in his local lab, he's sending out photons isotropically. And so locally here there's a certain flux of photons that escape into this cone, and that flux is getting smaller and smaller. But where do those photons end up when they're getting out to large values of R? Well, they're being spread, you know, this critical orbit in all cases was actually heading toward the R equals 3m orbit, the spherical orbit. And so those photons are getting spread out over the whole sky.
Yeah.
And the thing is that there's fewer and fewer of them that are actually escaping, but they're getting spread over the same sky. And so the density that I see, if B has a detector that's only 1 square meter wide or whatever, he's capturing fewer and fewer photons.
So based on that, can we then say that the signal actually gets to B, but it is B cannot detect it because of the intensity that gets to B?
So I was hoping to do some calculations that are going to show some exponential behavior, but then the very last comment is that, yeah, in the real world, when you have detectors of a finite resolution or you know, finite capability, rather than seeing an exponential decay, actually the observer just sort of the star or the observer just goes black. I stop receiving any signals after a certain point. After a finite amount of time. It's not something that takes an infinite amount of time. Well, let's see if we can do at least one calculation.
Shucks. Oh, well. Let's do one calculation and ask... What am I asking? So how fast does B see A approach R equals 2m. So, I've got some set of signals. They're coming from RA at some time, TA, and they're being received up here at a radius that I call capital R. And for simplicity, I'll call his time capital T. And so this, well, okay. I don't think I'm going to correct for it because we're running out of time, but this is the coordinate time. But if R is sufficiently big, then this coordinate time is basically the same as the proper time of that observer. But of course, proper time for R, for A is not the same as the coordinate time, and that's going to be important. So So A follows, well, okay, I'm supposed to, now, okay, we're running out of time. A follows some trajectory. Which I'm going to label with R and T. Now, a simple trajectory that we had last day was some was a geodesic trajectory, an infalling radial geodesic trajectory, and we actually made a choice that that the little e, well, L was equal to 0 because it's radially infalling, and we actually set E equals 0. The lowercase e equals actually 1 so that the effective energy was 0 because that made the integrals easy. And what we ended up with was so we had T over 2m was equal to some constant. Minus 2/3 R over 2M to the 3/2 minus 2 R over 2M to the 1/2 plus the logarithm R over 2M So I'm pulling that out of a hat, and then I'm going to make the statement that, well, we could imagine tuning, you know, the initial conditions for the star, and so for A's trajectory to match this particular trajectory. But the key point is going to be, though, that in fact, I'm always going to see independent, this is a very special trajectory, but the claim is that independent of the details of the trajectory, what I'm going to see is this logarithmic divergence, this particular behavior, irrespective of the details of the trajectory. And that's a reflection of the fact that the trajectory is going from finite values of R and T to R equals 2m, where T is actually equal to plus infinity. So the claim is that that divergence is generic. And so that was the point of writing out that equation, and we're going to put that aside for the moment. And I'll plug it into the equation in a moment, or in a second. This line is just a line at 45 degrees in or this the signal along which the null line along which the signals are propagating is just a line at 45 degrees in the UV plane. And so the signal And so I get to write something like U minus V equals a constant. Or alternatively, if I pick this point down here and call that UAVA, that's going to be the same as VB and minus UB, the UV, where those are the UV labels for the observer who's getting the signal. So but now, unfortunately, I have to rely on another formula that I gave you last day, which were, what was U and what was V in terms of these coordinates R and T? And one of the things you may remember is there were factors of R in front, and then there was a cosh and a sinh. And it turns out that this difference ends up giving me just an exponential. And so the claim is that at the end of the day, what I get is this prefactor. So that was the prefactor that was common to both terms in the coordinate transformation. And then the cosh and the sinh combined to give me a minus t up there. And then I get to do the same thing out at the observer. And so this turns into a formula with capital R's and capital T's. And what I'm really interested in is the behavior close to the horizon, or as I'm approaching the horizon. So what I say is, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to study this result for R is equal to 2m plus some correction. And I'm going to treat the equations, treating this as much, much less than 2m. Now, what I can, I should explain this. What I can see is that here I've got R over 2m minus 1. And so this term is going to contribute some power of epsilon to the 1 half. So then I've got this e to the r over 4m, but r is basically 2m, and so this is just giving me some the square root of e up to small corrections. Now, the interesting question then is, how does this t contribute to this expression on the left-hand side? And so there's a bunch of different terms. There's some constant term. There's these powers of R. But again, R is basically 2m up to small corrections. And so these are all just contributing some corrections. And in fact, if I'm not following that particular geodesic, I'm going to get some stuff. The key thing is, though, that the logarithmic divergence the divergence is coming because there's this factor that vanishes as R approaches 2m, and it's coming with a logarithm. Time is up in the exponential. Time is running out on my watch. And so what I'll say is that that e to the minus 4m also contributes a power of epsilon to the 1/2. But I'll have to leave that as an exercise. So what you're going to do, you're going to plug r equals 2m plus epsilon into this logarithm, put it up into the exponential with minus t divided by 4m. And what you'll find is that the e minus t over 4m on the left-hand side also contributes an epsilon to the 1/2. Of course, there are all sorts of factors that are basically, you know, numerical factors like this square root of e that are floating around up here as well. There are also higher order terms, higher powers of epsilon in this expression. But if I approximate it, then what I get is just some number on the left-hand side and then a linear power of epsilon because of those two contributions contributing or combining. On this side, again, I've got stuff with capital R's, but capital R is just some fixed quantity. The observer is moving forward in time. This isn't quite his proper time, but it's close to his proper time. And so on the other side of the equation, I'm getting some other number, e to the minus capital T over 4m. And so what I've discovered then is that the trajectory, as B describes it, as he's approaching the horizon, is that r equals 2m plus a small correction, where there's a number here, and then e to the minus 2 over 4m. And this, well, that's a number that depends on things like r and m. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, but the interesting feature is that I have this exponential behavior according to the observer out here. And we can see that because it's an exponential, I'm never quite going to get to r equals 2m. And so one reaction is, well, that's saying that he's slowing down and it takes forever to get there. The other way, the other thing to note, though, is that this time scale that characterizes the exponential behavior is actually a tiny time scale. So, So what we've shown is we've quantified this fact that that A never quite reaches R equals 2m according to B, but the motions timescale 4m, I can think of in regular units as being 2 milliseconds, or 2 times 10 to the minus 3 seconds, times whatever the mass of our black hole or our collapsing star is compared to the mass of the sun. So remember, the things that are collapsing have masses that are larger than twice the mass of the sun, but we can think of objects where that's a number of order one, and then I'm getting a time scale that's order milliseconds, and that's, well, in astrophysics, that's an incredibly small time scale. Then, since we've run out of time, I'll just say that the redshift and the decay of the luminosity are also characterized by this same exponential. And so that's a generic behavior. But then there was also this comment that, you know, in real systems, we have finite resolution, finite size detectors. And so we would... we lose the signal in a finite amount of time. So rather than getting these exponentially infinite long tails, the detector would just stop registering anything in a finite amount of time. So that went by pretty quickly, but are there any questions?
If not, I guess it's lunchtime.